Ahead in Midday's second hour, we continue our coverage and conversation of Freddie Gray's death and Baltimore's state of emergency, the curfew, the cleanup, and how the city will heal. Among the casualties of the riots on Monday night were a community center and apartments for senior citizens under construction in East Baltimore. The project was nearly complete after 8 years of work when it was burned to the ground. The cause of the fire is under investigation. In this hour, we'll hear how the community plans to start rebuilding. Plus, we talk about the Black Lives Matter movement and how Freddie Gray's death fits into the larger picture of police brutality with commentator Kay Wise Whitehead. That's Midday after the news. And welcome back. It's the second hour of Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. In this hour of the show, we hope to hear from or have a visit in our studio from the Reverend Dante Hickman of Southern Baptist Church in East Baltimore, the church that lost that under-construction community center and apartments for senior citizens in the fire Monday night. We're going to talk to him about it's the effect of that fire on the community and what their plans are now. So that'll be coming up a little bit later on in this hour of the show. We welcome phone calls again. Open phone lines here on the Midday Show, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. We're on Twitter at Dan Rodericks or midday@wypr. Joining me in the studio now is Kay Wise Whitehead, Associate Professor of Communications and African and African-American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland. Kay, it's nice to have you back on the show. We haven't
had you
on the show for a while, I'm sorry to say, but it's nice to see you.
I appreciate it.
You've been out on the street. You've been up on North Avenue, Pennsylvania Avenue. Where have you been?
Well, I've been out in the streets for the last week and a half or so. I started volunteering with the Political Prisoners Radio, and I reached out to them and saying, because I do communication, is there something I can do to help? What do you need?
What's Political Prisoners Radio?
Well, it's an internet-based radio station, and they look to raise the stories of people who have been incarcerated and people who are currently in the system. So when they said they needed people who were either medics or they needed legal aid or someone to witness what was happening, to get the phone numbers to people. And then I was told that they needed a social media commentator, which to me was exactly what I would do in terms of going out into the streets every day, going to the different places where things were happening, taking pictures, recording oral interviews, talking to people and trying to get a sense of what the real stories were out there.
And where did your travels take you? Say, over the weekend, did you take part in the marches on Saturday?
I did. I started off early Saturday morning. I got about 9:30 to 10 a.m. Up on Mountain Riggs to Freddie Gray's neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And they did have protesters out there early on. And they were speaking on the mic. And these were his friends and family members. And they were talking about Pepper and telling their stories about him. Pepper is his nickname. And they were talking about what they felt should happen in Baltimore City. And one of the things that one person said, and he said he was one of the best friends of Freddie Gray, he said, Baltimore City is not Ferguson. We don't want that to happen. We just want to be heard. So when I walked around asking people, why are you here? It was everything to, I want justice. I want things to change. I want the police to stop harassing us. I'm here because I lost a cousin to the police. I'm here because I've been harassed by the police. So I moved from Mountain Riggs down to the Western Police District. I went down there and I gathered stories. And I was waiting for the march to start. So between the protesters who were part of Freddie Gray's family and the Black Israelites who were reading from the Bible, you had this this conflict going on of who has the space and who has the right to tell their story.
How about the last couple of days since the disturbances on Monday, the fires,
yes,
vandalism, looting on Monday, and then a much quieter day yesterday?
Yes, well, I started on Sunday at the wake on York Road, and I went in, of course, to pay my respects, but I stood outside with some of his community members, and that's when they kind of created this middle lane down York Road in front of the funeral home all the way up until the McDonald's, and they had the music turned up loud, they had signs in the streets, and they asked people to honk for Freddie Gray. Hmm. And so if you wanted to pass, you were honking for Freddie Gray, and it was a diverse crowd. crowd in terms of age and gender and race, and even from communities, because there were people from that community. And that was Sunday. And when I was talking to people on Sunday, they said something more is happening. We don't feel like we're being heard. We're not going to do this today for Freddie, but something is being planned. I did not know what. And then on Monday, when I heard about the disturbances that were starting to take place, what they call the beginning of the Baltimore uprising, I did go down as far as I could. I went over to the Mondawin area just a little bit to kind of see what was going on. I had an event on Monday night, and I tried to get back over there. But by that time, it was just completely out of hand in so many ways to try to connect with what was going on. I went up on Tuesday morning back up to that community to see what had happened in the aftermath, to go to the Metropolitan UMC Church to volunteer for the breakfast program. When I arrived on Landvale, I arrived to see a man being arrested. And so because we're now citizen journalists, we all pull out our phones to immediately record. And he yells out his name and his address. And he says, "Can you go get my wife?" And he said something to me that just really
excuse me. Do you know what he was being arrested for?
I do not know. I got there as they were going through his pockets. And so I said, "I'm going to record this for you." And
Do you think it was related to vandalism or looting or something?
What I had heard is that there was a store in the community that had been looted. Now, his wife said he was going in there just to get a cigarette. Lucy is what she called it. Other people said that perhaps he was participating. He said, "Don't let me be forgotten." And so I did go and find his wife. I told him. In fact, she reached out to me today that she has not been able to find him. So I gave her the number to the legal aid. I wrote the number on my arm so that no matter what happens, I have it to give to people.
Thank you for noting. I saw the hashtag Baltimore Uprising has been being used in the last few days. But, you know, this gets tricky to sort out. We've been trying to hear peaceful protests over Freddie Gray's death, disturbance Saturday night, damage, destruction, 34 arrests or so, something like that. Fairly quiet day Sunday, except for what you describe on York Road there.
A little bit of noise.
Yeah. Then the funeral, and then this almost surreal sequence of events that we saw here on the midday show. It was a police putting out an alert about that a credible threat that police officers are being targeted by gang members in Baltimore. And then within the next hour, an alert sent out from the University of Maryland Baltimore downtown campus that they were closing because of anticipation of possible violence. And then, you know, by 3 o'clock or so, a little bit after that, these disturbances at Mondawmin, and then before you know it, there's fires and there's smoke, there's tear gas, there's riots in Baltimore. And it's sort of hard to, you know, not hard to, but I feel like I have to articulate and separate out these events a little bit. And, you know, the rumor of the purge, I didn't throw that in there because that's an important ingredient too. So I asked Munir Bahar in the earlier hour, do you think we would have had this purge, a day of lawlessness, riots, if not for the death of Freddie Gray? What is your speculation on that?
Well, I first want to agree with you. I think that we should separate these into three different things. That the beginning, which was the peaceful protest, I mean, they had been going on for 9 days. They were meeting every day at 5 o'clock. Some days they were calling for a 3 o'clock meeting, but meeting in the community and then marching down to City Hall to stand and to be there and be witness to what was happening, to push our city government towards making some change. There was a major shift on Saturday because when you march down to Camden Yards and you come into a community where people are in bars, they are drinking, and the N-word was used quite a lot towards people, then you had the scuffle. And I honestly felt that perhaps that was the end of it, that we had this scuffle, but there had been so many days of peaceful protest. And then it was down for the wake. I mean, you know, the little honking on York Road really was nothing. It was just kind of show support, which I thought would work. They were very quiet inside the funeral home. And then Monday was just a massive event, like, I mean, a televised Whitney Houston-type funeral where you couldn't even get in and you know, bombarded by the cameras when you were coming out. And then this shift happened again on Monday afternoon.
And then another shift into Tuesday.
Another shift. And then if you go up there today, which I've been up there already, it's much more calm. It has a less celebratory appeal and effect and affect to it. That there's another shift that has taken place, so that when people have been calling it an uprising, the Baltimore uprising, and true, it has been people on the ground that have been using the term uprising with those that are kind of speaking about the event, calling it a riot. It's the idea, how do we name and claim these activities? That can you support the uprising? And how are you defining that? Do we mean that we're uprising in a terms that we don't want this to happen in our communities anymore? Mm-hmm. We want to see a shift in the ways in which the police the community and criminalize the black male body. We want to talk about what's happening in low-income communities. Are we talking about job training, changing curriculum?
Well, it's all of that.
It's a multitude of issues.
It could be all of that. It could be all of that. It shouldn't include violence, looting, and destruction of property.
It should not. And so can you support one without the other? I am in support of an uprising, of bringing a change to the system. What happened on Monday was, in so many ways, using the word that you use, absolutely surreal.
Yeah.
Like just when you're watching it and you're listening to it and you're trying to figure out what's happening. And the feeling was that stuff was happening everywhere. And there were almost parallels to the 68 riot. But we know not in the same way.
Not
because
in the same scope.
In the aftermath, it wasn't the same thing. But that was the feel of it, at least in the moment on Monday night.
Kay Wise Whitehead with us from Loyola University at Maryland. 410-662-8780. Howlett has been holding, and I want to go to start taking some calls from our listeners here. And Kay, please join me in speaking with our listeners.
Absolutely.
Howlett in Baltimore. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I was going to talk about something else, but one thing I was going to say is I wasn't surprised that the kids throwing rocks at the cops. I live about two blocks from Mondawmin Mall. I'm over at the bus depot mostly every day. And every day I see the kids, when they get off the bus, the police harass them incessantly. Every time I see them get off the bus.
Harass them?
In the afternoon when the kids get off the bus, the cops will be there trying to tell them. As soon as the kid might have just gotten off the bus, and I see the cop, where are you going? Move on. Where are you going? Well, I'm going home. Well, what bus are you catching? And so on and so forth. Well, that wasn't what I mainly called. The main thing I was thinking about here.
Well, Howlett, excuse me. Before you go on, I think that's interesting. Is this a daily thing? Have you seen this on a regular basis?
Yes, on a regular basis. If I'm up there at the time that the kids get off of school, I see the police up there harassing them, pushing them. Well, where are you going?
Physically pushing
they
them, touching
them?
No. They have the little baton. They tell the kids to move on.
Okay.
Well, where are you going? Where are you going? And somebody said, I'm going home. I just got off the bus. What bus you get off of? Well, which bus are you going to catch? And so on and so forth. And then the cops will look over there and see if that bus is there or whatever. Well, that bus is there and there. Get on the bus.
Okay.
Right.
Just pulled in.
It was a little bit different on Monday because the word is that there were a number of buses that the police told them not to stop, to keep going. So you had kids that could not get on any bus. So now you have crowds of kids gathering because if your bus pulls off, what are you going to do but continue to stand and gather?
The police, though. The police saying they don't want more kids coming either, right?
Right.
That might have contributed to some of the kids who might have been mad or say they throw a rock or two and catch their bus and go home. But when they couldn't go anywhere, they might have stayed around. But what I was really calling about was that we usually think about this problem with the excess crime and the insurrection. I think the big underlying problem is lack of economic opportunity. And I think if we're going to solve the problem, I think the big thing is that we have to look at things slightly differently. And I think Baltimore has two massive assets that really would be a good combination. One big asset is all of these able-bodied, poorly educated people who are trying to find jobs, and then we have this massive blight of homes which are all boarded up, but a lot of them are brick and good solid structures, and if they were rehabbed, they would provide some excellent affordable housing. Huh. And the thing is, now the big question is, what about money?
Yeah.
What about money?
All right. Howlett, I appreciate your comments here. I mean, there is an opportunity here.
Right. To perhaps bring about some economic change in the community.
Well,
but
this has been a problem for a long time, festering problem, and maybe now, I don't know.
But are people
cynical, and they'll say, as soon as the TV cameras leave, it'll all go back to being the same way. I've received some very, sort of cynical, pessimistic comments about what comes of all this?
You know? I was listening to some of the stories of small business owners who lost their properties and who were saying things like, this is all we had. My whole life is tied up in this business, and whether or not we're going to be able to rebuild and come back. I mean, to get that target to be back in control of that community in terms of being an economic stronghold, a place where people can work and get goods, to get the CVS rebuilt. Is that really going to happen? Yeah. I mean, are businesses, do they want to put money into
communities
where this has
happened? And the mayor made the point about how hard it was to get the CVS there to begin with, and other investments like a supermarket. We talk about food deserts in Baltimore City and parts of East and West Baltimore. How is this going to happen now? I got a very pessimistic email from someone this morning who felt that this is a really serious setback for Baltimore, agreeing with me with a statement that Baltimore is broken. I say the relationship between police and Baltimore citizens is a lot of Baltimore citizens is broken. That's broken. But there's something else that's broken
here that we
need to get to. And are we going to see future investment in the city? Are people going to continue to? The mayor wants to grow the city by 10,000 families within a decade of when she said that, which was in 2011, I believe, right?
And whether or not that's going to happen.
Yeah, are we going to get there?
I don't know. We had one day of riots. I mean, there was a little bit of spill after that.
Yeah.
But I argue, and I've spoken to some small business owners, that they feel like we're being put back 10 years, maybe 20 years. Look how long it took to get businesses to begin to invest in Baltimore, to have this happen. How do you get businesses to turn around, forget what happened on Monday and Tuesday? I mean, we're still under a curfew now, under a state of emergency, to get them to want to reinvest their money back into the city, because food deserts are real.
Well,
if you burn your CVS,
even
you're
importantly,
burning your products.
And reinvest specifically in those areas that really need it, like East and West Baltimore, and not just downtown Canton and Southeast Baltimore and South Baltimore. Let's take another call before we take our next break, and then we'll take some more. 410-662-8780 from Harford County. Nick is the caller. Thanks for calling in, Nick.
I appreciate you taking my call. I mean, I think first off, I just want to say I think this is an incredibly valuable conversation, and I've been most impressed by a lot of the reporting that's been done on NPR, in particular your show.
Thank you.
I guess my comment is twofold and a question. We're hearing an awful lot, not only on the media, but, you know, in, I think, individuals' discussions of what's going on in Baltimore, limiting it to Baltimore. I think it's important to note that it is a broader systemic issue, and it is, as it revolves around class in these urban communities that have been decimated for a very, very long time. I guess my question is that while we separate the personal from the political and say that it's very devastating to the individuals and small businesses in these communities, but there is a very real problem here that is, I think, also kind of getting missed. While this was calmed very quickly and not a lot of damage was done, we keep hearing comparisons to the riots in 68 and how much more comprehensive in enveloping the city they were and how many more people were involved. Why wasn't more damage done? Why is it good that community leaders are dismantling this and de-escalating it when these are very real problems that perhaps should be being escalated? And more damage should be being done. I mean, I know that that sounds awful nihilist, but this
I think
is a
you
big
can,
problem.
I think it, Nick, stay with us now. I think, I want you to know this. I mean, I think you can make the point now without doing any more damage. I think the point was made on Monday of what the potential is here, how scary it is. And those who did this, you know, burned buildings, burned automobiles, trashed businesses, only got so far, right? They did this mostly in neighborhoods where they live. And, I mean, we can go on from here, don't you think, Kay, without more destruction?
I think we can. I think people are beginning to try and make comparisons to 68. I mean, I said that earlier, but in a bigger, broader way, it's not 1968. The country was in a very different place. At the end of those riots, I mean, you're talking 7 people died. You're talking, you know, you had $10 million worth of damage. You're talking 1,200 fires.
Yeah, 5,000 arrests.
That's a very different time. The city was deeply divided at that time. You don't have that now, that you have communities that have come together. One of the things that you saw in these days of protest was how racially diverse it was. It wasn't just all African Americans out there marching and saying Black Lives Matter. It was white Americans, white Baltimoreans coming from universities, coming from the parts of the town where they're you know, upper class communities, coming from lower class communities. It's so diverse that when something like this happens, because we are invested in our city, we do not want to see it burn. I was one of the people calling for a de-escalation of these tensions, because at the end, if everything gets burned down, then where do we live? Where do we shop? Where do we send our kids to school?
But Nick's got a point. Without, I don't agree with him that there should be more destruction to keep it going. And I don't even think he thinks that. But it's like this voice needs to constantly be heard. This has got to be sustained. And, you know, President Obama, you heard his comments yesterday, but
yes.
You asked President Obama, well, what are you going to do about it? You know, first, dealing with police brutality is one thing. And then what about this high concentration of poverty that we have in this country? You know, at the federal minimum wage level, $7.25 an hour, if you work 60 hours a week, you're still below the government set poverty line in the United States. We have so many working poor in the United
yes.
States. And you ask President Obama, what are you going to do about that? What's Congress going to do about that? And there's no answer there. So
I don't think anyone has any answers.
Well,
people ask me, do I think the system is broken? I said the system is working exactly like it's supposed to work. Those that have continue to move forward and continue to prosper. Those that are holding up society, that's the working poor, that's the lower middle class, those that are trying to find a way to get their family out of the cycle of poverty, it is not being broken.
KY's Whitehead with me on the Midday Show, 410-662-8780. And we hope in the remainder of the show we get to hear from Reverend Dante Hickman about his church in the Southern Baptist Church in East Baltimore and the fire over there Monday night. And we'll take some more calls. A short break on Midday. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Right back to the phone lines. Michael in West Baltimore, you're next. Welcome to the Midday Show.
Yes, hi, Dan. Hi. I work in West Baltimore at Roots and Branch School, and although I'm up here in Towson picking up my son in St. Pius because there's a planned peaceful protest down York Road, and they're saying there might be some traffic issues. But anyway, my heart goes out to the children there because they're all impacted. I work in the kindergarten class, and you know, I think the children always need to be kept in mind. But my question is, it goes out to a conversation I had with a colleague, like when they say that you can't, you know, like the curfew, the no dogs can leave their home at 10 o'clock, what's the constitutional basis for that? I mean, I thought you had to declare maybe martial law or something like that in order to do that. So that's my question, and I'll take my answer off the air.
I don't have a formal answer for you, and I have to go look it up. I would say a city ordinance allows the mayor to declare a curfew. Also, we have curfews in the city as a city ordinance already. Go ahead, Kay.
Okay, it was actually taken up, just to answer the caller, it was actually taken up by the Supreme Court in 1943 with the Kiyoshi case, talking about whether or not cities could impose a curfew. And they agreed that cities during a time of war, and the word war was never actually defined, could call for a curfew. Now, in the 90s, there was a challenge to that. They put in a writ of certiorari, and the Supreme Court chose not to hear that. So it's not unconstitutional for a city, when it feels that this is the only response to get a city back under control, is to call for a curfew law. Now, she has not called for martial law, and people are confusing the two. I mean, there was a curfew for high schoolers anyway.
Yeah.
There's been a curfew during school nights, which I absolutely agree with.
Council.
As part of
yeah.
city council. Mm-hmm. So this idea of 10 o'clock, the curfew is, as I tell people when they feel that they're being inconvenienced. I said that she did not do a 5 o'clock curfew. She didn't do a 7 p.m. curfew.
It was 10
she did
PM.
A 10 p.m. curfew
yeah.
from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. And if you are someone where you are working a job, or if you are working at the hospital, if you have an emergency, you are allowed to move around. If you're going to the hospital, they're not going to stop you and arrest you and send you home. But we're talking about getting the city back under control. And I'd like to have anyone challenge me on why they don't think that's a good thing.
Let's take another call. This is Andrew in Reservoir Hill. You're on Midday. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Dan. How are you?
Oh, pretty good.
I'm calling to sort of echo something that your guest has said. I read a report on Mother Jones that the police on Monday, hearing that this purge might happen, were over at Mondawmin and the bus stops where there's this big interchange. And you know, these high school kids, they're using city buses and the subway as their way home. They ordered all the kids off the bus, wouldn't let them get on to the subway, wouldn't let them do anything, and the crowd just kept growing. And what Mother Jones reported is that it was peaceful at first, but the kids after a while said, you know, we want to go home, we want to get on the buses, we want to get on the trains. They weren't allowed. And if this is true, it's possible that the police may have taken a bad situation and made it much worse. And I'm hopeful that, you know, we're going to look very closely into this to find out what the cause of that first spark that ultimately ended up in being a very, very bad night for our city.
Thank you very much. I saw the Mother Jones piece, too. Like I said before, I know I might make excuse for city leaderships and city leadership, and I believe there should be scrutiny, and there will be. My newspaper will do a job on that, I think, already starting to work on that. But split-second decisions, things were happening so quickly, rumors, gossip, highly unusual situation that the police found themselves in here. And I'm a little reluctant to get into the quarterbacking on this, the Monday morning, Tuesday morning, Wednesday afternoon quarterbacking on those decisions. Should we keep the buses running? Would the buses be endangered? Would the buses be pelted with bricks and stones? You got a matter of minutes to make decisions about these things, and
And not all of them are good decisions, and not all of them are bad decisions. I think these are quick moment decisions where you're trying to figure out what is in the best interest of the community and ways to keep these young people safe. And when you look at the restraint, I know there are a number of people who criticize the police for the restraint, but these were kids and they did not attack them, did not drag them off. Now, things have happened since then, but in that initial response on Monday night, they were taking the students off the bus. I saw it across my Facebook and my Twitter line, asking people, if you're in the community, can you drive over to help get kids home, to give them a ride? But in trying to get over, there were barriers to getting over to that area because they were trying to prevent what some people have been calling Purge Part 1.
Let's take another call. Bernie in Montgomery County, thanks for calling. Go right ahead.
Yeah, Dan, I wish we could get some credible estimates of how many people were on the street during various of these incidents. Baltimore is a city of 600,000 people, metro area of more than 2 million. And I believe only a tiny percentage of the community participated in looting or violence. For instance, the Center Street incident, was there 100 people there, or 500, or 1,000? At Mondawmin Mall, was there 1,000 or 10,000? Or 100,000? I've been to, war demonstrations where there are many, many thousands of people in the 60s. So I think we need to put this and many more than that in 1968, too, of course. I think we need to put this into perspective with just some estimates. Doesn't have to be exact numbers, obviously, but at least we could say fewer than 10,000, something like that.
Okay. Sounds like an old newspaper editor. Can we get a number on this? Old Bernie. Having worked in a newspaper job for a long time now, I know about estimates. As soon as you print them, someone squawks that it's not correct. We go to the fire department usually for this. People complain that the fire department estimate on crowds Saturday downtown were not accurate, underestimated the number of marchers. We should send a drone up or something and do a scan from the sky. And when Obama was President Obama's first inauguration, there was an estimate made using some sort of sky scan. Maybe we should do that to give it a perspective. And I think he's pointing out that a small number of people took part in this, but small number of people can cause a lot of problems.
But I do think that speaks to a bigger issue, though. This idea that one thing that the caller said, it wasn't all of Baltimore that was involved in what was happening. It was a small percentage. There was a lot of damage. And maybe that explains how it was brought under control so quickly. I mean, it did not spill over into Tuesday. You had small little skirmishes, but nothing like Monday night. And it seems to be much calmer today because it's not all of the city. When people are now pushing this idea of #OneBaltimore, along with #BlackLivesMatter, it's this notion of we are trying to at least be solution-oriented. And I think that speaks going beyond the community. They did peaceful protest. And it seems like everyone didn't start talking about what was happening until you have what happened from Saturday and on Monday.
Kay Wise Whitehead is an associate professor of communications and African American studies at Loyola University, Maryland. She's also the author of Letters to My Black Sons. What's the subtitle of that book?
Raising Boys in a Post-Racial America. And post-racial does have a question mark behind it.
Hmm. And who's the publisher of the book?
Apprentice House out of Loyola University.
Thank you, Kay. Also, want to welcome to the show now Eric Booker. Eric Booker is a president of the New Broadway East Community Association from the east side of Baltimore. Nice to have you with us, Eric.
Thank you so much, Dave.
And we hope Reverend Dante Hickman of the Southern Baptist Church will be able to join us today. We still got 20 minutes to go in the hour. I know he said he would make an effort to get here.
Yes.
He was taking part in police accountability rally.
That's correct.
At the state's attorney's office. But we invited Eric here to talk about the fire Monday night. The fire Monday night at a facility that was supposed to be a community center and apartments for senior citizens.
That's correct.
That has been destroyed, was destroyed on Monday night. And Eric, this is at the intersection of three streets.
That's right.
North Chester, Federal, East Federal,
mm-hmm.
and Gay.
That's correct.
Right? So tell us about, first of all, your community association's involvement in that project so we understand why you're here.
Sure, sure. We had been working with Southern Baptist Church and Dante Hickman for about 8 years, trying to get to the right location, the right mix for the community. The church had its vision, and we wanted to make sure that the church's vision folded into what the community desired as well. And we all agreed that senior housing was important. We all agreed that there were no amenities within the community, and this would be something that would help to eliminate some of the blight at a critical crossroads within a community. That actually is the center of Broadway East, that those three intersections. That's the center of Broadway East. Used to be very vibrant during my childhood. And we agreed on the content. We knew that we needed senior housing. We knew that we needed places for the community to come and just kind of gather. And we knew we needed workforce development stuff. Humanum does that. They were going to also do that as well.
Let me just mention for folks, or pin this on the map for people who are familiar with the old American Brewery.
That's right.
Which was renovated by Humanum.
Yes.
And now that's their headquarters.
That's exactly.
And they've already done some redevelopment of housing in that area.
That's exactly right. And Humanum came and they opened their doors to us. We have our community association meetings there. And Reverend Dante Hickman was going to do the same. Any type of events we needed to have, we had access to more amenities within the community. So needless to say that we shed some tears that night.
Where were you, Eric?
Oh, I was there.
I bet you were at home then.
I was there. I got a call that said it was on fire, and I was there in 2.5 seconds. And when I saw the Reverend pull up, we just kind of looked at each other and the tears started rolling. We hugged each other and we said, you know, this too will pass. And I said, okay, the tears are gone now. Let's get back in leadership mode.
How far along in construction was it?
We were just about to put the roof on. It was due to be completed in December timeframe. It was 30 days ahead of schedule. And what my gut tells me is would have probably been 60 days ahead of schedule. And just about put the roof on. And once the roof is on, everything is downhill from there.
What was the investment in that, the price tag, and how did the Reverend Hickman go about financing this?
It was a $16 million facility, and I wasn't intimately involved in the financing of it.
Okay.
I was just approaching it from the community side. And as long as it was inclusive of the thoughts of the community, we were happy.
When you say there aren't a lot of amenities in that neighborhood, in that area, I mean, that's putting it mildly, isn't it? I mean, there's no supermarket nearby that I can think of.
Yeah.
Can you describe the general area, aside from American Brewery and the Humanum campus there? What else is there?
We have 4,000 vacant structures in the Broadway East community. The old Brown supermarket has been gone for years. The American Brewery was shut down my entire childhood. We used to go in the brewery and catch pigeons and raise pigeons. And we were so thankful when Humanum came. But all you have is a series of corner stores and liquor stores. You know, we have over 25 liquor licenses in Broadway East alone. 25 liquor licenses in Broadway East alone.
Is that an area that's been targeted for some of the rezoning efforts to eliminate the density of liquor stores?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the zoning effort is a citywide effort, but we have lifted our voice to that in Broadway East. We do not need 25 liquor licenses when we don't have a grocery store. Mm. Truly a food desert.
So we're going to take a break here and come back and talk some more. Several people have asked us how they can help very distressed by the loss of this project in East Baltimore. So why don't we take a break? We'll come back and take some phone calls, and then you can tell us about that effort. We know that a lot of people have reached out already to Reverend Hickman at Southern Baptist Church. By the way, the church and the facility were on the same side of the street or opposite?
No, across the street.
Across the street. Thanks very much. Eric Booker is with us, KY's Whitehead. This is Midday. Dan Roderick's here. Short break. We'll be right back. Let me slip in a call from one of our listeners here, Susan. Susan Fisher at the Baltimore Community Mediation Center wanted to tell us something. Hi, Susan. Thanks for calling Midday.
Hi. We wanted to let everybody know that we are open today as an open house at 3333 Greenmount Avenue, the Community Mediation Center, for people that just want to, like, come in, get a hug, be heard, talk about what they can do, what they can give. And also, the mediation center is here and can really be instrumental in helping foster some of the dialogue and facilitating the dialogue that needs to happen for healing to begin in the community between youth, police, community leaders. And if people want to get involved in that and or even learn about how they can get some mediation training, we're here.
All right, Susan, thank you very much. That's the Baltimore Community Mediation Center. Mark in Towson, for your comment. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thank you very much. I enjoy it. I applaud your guest for her optimism and her glass half full approach to some of these things. Being much more of the pessimistic bent, I have to say that the direct impact of the economic impact of the events of late in the city with respect to the stores and the store owners and so forth is very obvious. But I think the near-term and maybe longer-term impact of the horrific images spread out all over the world of Baltimore in the last couple of days is going to mean that any economic development that may have come from outside the Baltimore, Maryland area is practically non-existent at this point. I mean, at least in the near term. I can't imagine anybody who's in a decision-making position from another area considering offers from multiple locations, including Baltimore or Maryland. We just made their job a little easier in as much as one of those offers is now off the table, namely Baltimore and Maryland. It's a disaster as far as attracting outside because of these images, which are not subtle, are not nuanced, do not tell the whole story, obviously. I just think that the impact of this is just going to be horrific as far as the economics in terms of investment in the area. But anyway, I applaud your efforts and your guests to try to take a more optimistic approach to this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. And, you know, the governor of Maryland has a role to play in this. This is going to be very interesting. And I'm not just talking about the politics of it. I'm talking about real public policy, real interest, commitment. The governor of Maryland, from a mostly white suburban area, upset election in November, shown that he's very interested in Baltimore, has made a lot of statements even before these problems, saying that Baltimore is the economic driver of the region. We have to make sure that Baltimore succeeds. He said that before we had these troubles, and he's on top of this.
Yeah, he moved his office here, which I think was a huge statement.
Yeah. So
he was doing flyovers, so he's actively involved in it.
Yeah, and he's a businessman. Elected governor. And I think he's going to say, you know, what can we do to drive this a little more? You know, connect West Baltimore and East Baltimore a little bit more with this dynamo downtown that we have going here so that we don't lose this momentum from this. Mark is right. I mean, there's a lot to overcome with these images that have gone around the world. Baltimore is already hurt by certain reputations
and
a homicide rate and all that.
Yes,
that right?
Number of things.
There. Now you add this, and Mark is correct. But I think this is where the governor, working with the mayor, could really do something, and the business community. You know, he's assembled a task force on how to make Maryland more business friendly. Had the former CEO of Lockheed Martin as the chairman of that, who said that he was very concerned about income inequality in Maryland. So maybe you can bring all this together and focus on Baltimore.
I think that he can. I also think when the guest said about the idea that I have the glass half full kind of idea. I'm from Washington, D.C. When I grew up, it was the Myrtle capital of the world. Now they're talking about moving an old game down there because it's safer. So I know how communities can change. I know how cities can change. I also believe that as Americans, we tend to be short-term orientation people. So we get upset about something that happens, and then we build the bigger Twin Towers, even taller and higher, because we build over our ruins and we keep going. It's something about our strength and our tenacity. And I think Baltimore City has an opportunity now, because this conversation is on the table, it is not going anywhere, that we have to take a look at what is going on and we have to think of ways to transform our communities if we want to live here.
Well, transform and rebuild. Mm-hmm. So now we're back over to East Baltimore with Eric Booker from the New Broadway East Community Association, who's worked with Reverend Hickman, who so far has not been able to join us in our studio here. I'm sure he got tied up at the rally downtown. But anyway,
yes.
So what happens next, Eric? Did you stand on the street and say, we will rebuild, but $16 million is needed, or maybe more now?
Well, let me be clear. We will rebuild. I got that message from Reverend Hickman and all that were affiliated with that project. He said it may take a few months for us to re-engage permitting process, but we will rebuild. And all that does is give us an opportunity for a larger vision for the community. And as I spoke about a Humanum and Humanum's investment, I believe it was a $22 million investment in that American Brewery building. You know, it takes courage to do that in a place where you don't see any amenities. It takes courage to be the person that says, you know what, I'm going to put my flag down here and make a difference. Humanum made that investment. As a result of a Humanum making that investment, you start seeing a Mary Harvin Center, you see a Columbus School, you see a food hub. You see, it didn't stop at the train tracks. That was one of the challenges I had with the EBDI project. It stopped at the train tracks, which meant—
That's the Amtrak line.
The Amtrak, right? Which meant that I lived on the other side of the tracks. And I know what that stereotype means. It wasn't a natural barrier. It was the train tracks, and we're on the other side of the tracks. And that's what the community said. They stopped at the train tracks. So when a Humanum comes in and says, I'm going to do something here, and guess what? I hear you loud and clear. We are about workforce development. Everything that we do is about jobs. Well, that's what we need in that community.
Above the railroad tracks.
Above the railroad tracks.
North of there. North right. of Hopkins that's and right. the East Baltimore development area.
That's right. Right. That's right.
Yeah. Now, when Humanum came in, I believe their offices were in Howard County,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So here's this nonprofit out there in the county that says it's going to do this in East Baltimore. And I know some people are very skeptical about, you know, when an outside organization says they're going to come in and plant that flag in the community mm-hmm. and do something. They actually did it. But were people skeptical?
Let me tell you something. People have come to Broadway East many times talking about what they're going to do. And I'm going to be very honest. Most of them were white folks. Broadway East, very skeptical when white folks come and say that they want to do something, because there have often been promises that never been delivered on. You know, they would come and want to do surveys, gather data. You know, students would come and want to do gather data. And we want to know, where are we going with this data? And they sell you that they're doing something for the community that never happened. One thing that I will tell you about Henry Posco and Cindy Paver Truitt from Humanum.
Henry Posco?
Yes. He's the CEO and COO is Cindy. You know, they came and they came to the community association and they said, hey, this is what we like to do. And of course, the community sits back in the chair and say, here we go again. You know, so I had some dialogue with them to better understand what they brought to the community. So because there needed to be a voice that looked like me communicating to the people of the community, not just a voice from the outside once again saying, hey, guess what we want to do for you? So we partnered. And as a result of that partnering, you have the American Brewery. And another moment that I had tears in my eyes, when that building opened, I was sitting on the corner. It was night. I was coming back into the neighborhood, sitting on the corner of Wolf Street and North Avenue. And I looked over in that direction, and they had a flag lit up on top of the brewery. Mm. And that was a moment for me. And I said, now, that's a great beacon light of hope right there. That's where we start, on the other side of the tracks. Now let's color in everything in the middle.
Mm. Eric, could you tell us about how— Because people want to know how they can help Reverend Hickman and this rebuilding process.
Sure. We like I said, we're going to move forward, but the vision has to be bigger. So any type of contributions that can be made, and I'm going to mention two organizations here, you know, the Southern Baptist Church and Humanum. Because once again, I say it's easy to sit on the sideline and be a cheerleader and be skeptical. But it takes courage in neighborhoods like Broadway East to say, I'm going to try to make a difference. I'm going to try to help eliminate the blight and contribute to that. Humanum is working on the workforce development that some of the kids told me yesterday evening, Brother Eric, all we need is some jobs. We need an opportunity. Every morning I get up, I have absolutely nothing to do. So I stand on these corners. So they need jobs. Humanum had the courage. Southern Baptist Church has had the courage. They've shown their commitment. Any contributions that you can make to Humanum and Southern Baptist Church
helps that community.
Helps that community.
All right. Thank you, Eric Booker. We'll post some more information about both those organizations and Reverend Hickman's church. Reverend Hickman's church and Humanum on my Facebook page before we get off the air. So thank you very much. Eric Booker is president of the New Broadway East Community Association, and we've been talking to him about the rebuilding of the project. It's called
the Mary Harvin Center.
Who was Mary Harvin?
Mary Harvin was the first lady of the Southern Baptist Church way back in the beginning.
Way back in the day. Okay, yes. I'm sorry. Wow. I grew up Catholic, so I'm sorry. I hope I'm excused. Let's just try to take a couple of quick calls here, folks. We'll do it as quickly as possible. Pete in Baltimore. Go right ahead, Pete. Welcome.
Hi. We've been talking about, you know, these neighborhoods, the ones that are directly involved, and if that's all we're talking about, they're going to lose. I was a community organizer for many years, and until the society believes that we all have a stake in what happens to each of us, it's not going to work. At some point, we'll just the rest of us will just sort of say, well, good luck with that, and walk away, and the news cycle will move on. We need a mass movement for justice and equity. We need it. It needs to be on the level of the civil rights movement. It needs to be looking for a rational, humane way of organizing American life, because people are suffering everywhere, and when people suffer, they mistreat or ignore other people.
Okay.
I think that's a wonderful idea. I also want to add, it's already happening, that there is a massive movement that's taking place. People are organizing. People are coming together. It is going beyond these communities, but we're focusing on these communities because I think when there's a fire on your block, you go put out that fire first. Mm-hmm. Then you look to rebuild the rest of the community. We have fires happening in this community, and I use the word fire to talk about the income levels, talk about the blighted buildings, talk about, you know, the poverty. We're talking about the literacy rates. This is a fire that is happening in these low-income communities, and we've got to put those fires out. There are communities by Charles Village, you know, up in the Goldens area. There are some communities that right now they don't have a fire going on, but we need the people from that community to help us put these fires out because we all live in this city together.
We're down to our last minute. Doug, I'll go to you, but please be brief. Doug?
Hi. I was talking to some of the kids in my own neighborhood, and they were talking about, you know, one of them in particular mentioned his cousin was part of the people, part of the mob that raided the 7-Eleven. And all she got out with was a packet of Reese's peanut butter cups. And the mob was obviously made up of lots of angry people. They were made up of people who were out to loot. But I think the majority of the crowd was not there to make a statement. I'm sure she was angry like everybody is, but that's not why she was there.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yeah, maybe just a mess, and you step in,
mess.
You take a Reese's cup. And
there's one Reese's cup too many.
Yeah. Anyway, boy, we have more to talk about in the days and weeks and months ahead. I thank Kay Wise Whitehead for being here today. Thank you very much for joining
thank
us
you.
Again. Kay, we'll have you back soon, I hope.
I hope so.
And Eric Booker, once again, good luck over there.
Thank
with this
so
with
much.
This project. I'm glad you were on the show. I'm sorry Reverend Hickman didn't make it, but perhaps another day we'll get him in
here.
Yes,
I'll see him soon.
And thank you everybody for tuning in to Midday. We'll be back again tomorrow at noon.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Aaron Morenzi, Alexis Kuhn, and Aaliyah Satterfield. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.